Hello, I'm Hugo Dislett from Farming Secrets. I'd like to welcome everyone on this teleconference. We're going to reveal some exciting farming techniques as carried out by a dairy farmer or dairy farmers, Ron and Bev Smith, and they're interviewed by Dr. Martin Stapper, as seen on the DVD that was sent to our Farming Secret members. Later on, you'll be able to ask questions, or you can type them in, or the lines will be open later. This teleconference will go for about 1 hour. Online we have Dr. Martin Stapper, is that right? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Hugo.
And we have Ron and Bev Smith. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And Bev, are you there?
I am too, yes, thank you.
Good on you. I'll be briefly introducing Ron and Bev Smith and Martin. So Ron and Bev, your dairy farm's at Fish Creek in the Gippsland area of Victoria. That's in Australia, naturally. Gippsland is renowned for its dairy industry. It has a reasonably reliable rainfall. It's a cool, temperate part of Australia. Now, Martin, you're an agronomist and an agricultural engineer, and you've worked in the Netherlands, Canada, USA, Iraq, Syria, and since 1982 in Australia. Importantly, you have continually observed the role of soil biology in relation to farm profit. In other words, when you improve the soil biology, you improve farm profits. Is that a fair brief description of what you do, Martin, or
yes,
would you like to add anything to that?
No, that's exactly the description, to come to the awareness that it's the soil biology that drives the whole system. And then, of course, 12 years ago, I met Ron for the first time, and Ron, the way he talked about his farm, was exactly in that whole direction. And then visiting the farm, and what we now see on the DVD, it's a farm in action with all, the whole recycling of the minerals and the carbon into the soil and deep root systems of plants to go through the cows, and the manure is recycled, the effluent pond, etc. It's all recycled back onto the land, and it's a very productive, diverse system with all the consequences of healthy cows and happy, healthy farmers on the block. And
yeah. And Ron, would you like to give a brief rundown of your dairy enterprise? Bear in mind that most of the people who are going to listen to this CD have looked at the farm DVD, so you don't have to be don't have to repeat a whole lot. So could you like to give a brief rundown of your farming enterprise?
Yep, okay. The farm is actually a triangle. It's just under 100 hectares, and we can see Wilson's Promontory from the farm, and that's the southernmost tip of mainland Australia, so if anyone wishes to know exactly where we are. When we first moved here in 1978, Bev and I, we were married in 1970, and we share farmed for nearly 8 years and saved up enough to buy a herd of cows and shifted here and leased this farm for 2 years, and then in 1980 we put a deposit on it. It was actually a half a deposit, and a neighbour from Warrigal, or a farm not far away, he put up a block of land as security for the young couple, for us to get started. And I was always an asthmatic. I had a lot of problems with asthma, and as soon as we'd put the deposit on the farm, Bev said that we need to go away from all the chemical fertilisers and from the sprays and those sort of things, because I was very allergic to superphosphate, and that was one of the main things that farmers had to use on the land to actually grow grass. So we went away from those sort of things, pretty radical in those days, and just searched. We searched books and all sorts of places. It was very hard at that time to do it, but we found a few answers until we had some fantastic seasons and we had some very poor seasons. And then coming up into the early 90s, we we read some of Arden Anderson's work, Albrecht's work, and started finding the answers that we'd been searching for. So it's a long story right through to what's happening now. We're into biodynamics as well now that enhances the whole thing. But as well as doing that, we've actually paid for the home block. There's a new little block that's part of that triangle that we bought 3 years ago. We still owe a bit of money on that, but we've raised 11 children here and had a great time.
Yes, one question that I had about the issues on the DVD is the role of biodynamics, because they're always, like in biodynamics, we have the adherence to the strict biodynamics, that biodynamics will solve all the problems. And then with questions like the way you fit it in your system, that is about remineralizing, active remineralizing, and inoculating the soils with other microbes than the one from the BD500-501. The other criticism that people then ask, why do you use 500 in the evening and 501 in the morning? Because there's a big difference in 500 and 501 on the time of application. Like the whole cosmic system has to be earthy for the 500 and cosmic for the 501.
Mm-hmm.
Have you followed those stories in your farm, Ron? What works?
Yes.
And what doesn't work?
We feel for us the biodynamics is another cog in the wheel that enhances what we're actually doing. The reason we use the 500 in the evening or late afternoon is because the earth breathes. It breathes out during the first half of the day and breathes back in during the evening. And to show that, a simple illustration to show that is when you can go out of an early morning and see the mist rising off a dam or off a water somewhere, and you'll never see that of an evening, because the atmosphere is actually going up during the morning, and we use the 501, which is a silica spray, during the morning, and that puts it up into the atmosphere. It's like little tiny quartz crystals, and it works on the photosynthesis for the plants.
Yep.
And the actual 500, we use a horn clay and a combination preps, there's a few other things in there as well, which actually work in the soil itself. So one works in the atmosphere and the other works in the soil, and that's the reason we do it morning and evening.
And your experience, like with the 500, like with the new block, did you apply the 500 four times in the year to get the roots?
No, just twice.
Oh, twice
just
as well.
Just twice.
And
spring and autumn?
So twice using it in the new block really broke that barrier of the roots, and the roots went deep right from
first
year.
When we first moved here, we had a pH of around 4, very, very acid country. It was cleared in 1956, and if you go about a K and a half from here, you get into blue gum country, and that was cleared in 1884. So it took them nearly 70 years, or over 70 years, to actually move up into where we are at the moment. They called it the rubbish country because of the heavy clay, very shallow, and about 1 inch of topsoil we had here, and the new block, when we moved onto it, had a root mat of about 1 inch sitting on the clay, and below that there was no roots at all. So it was more or less, and the farms around here more or less have to hydroponic farm.
Yep.
And Ron, I do remember met you at around about 1990 or around the very early 1990s at Burnley Agricultural College. You were giving a talk there, and one very interesting thing, what I just remember for all these years, is that you said that a group of about 100 or so people there, and you said that you had a visit from a bank manager, and the local bank manager, who's sort of basically checking you out to see why you weren't having this sort of financial problems that other dairy farmers were, that other dairy farmers are causing him a fair bit of problems. So obviously you're doing something different back in around the 1990. Can you sort of expand a little bit on what I just said, or was that how true is what I just said, is it?
Yes, it was. It was in the late 90s, 97, 98, 99.
Huh?
We had a very wet year in 1996, and during 97, about October, it stopped raining, and it absolutely stopped. There was no rain at all. Got very, very dry, and one of our local towns here had over $1 million a day coming through it because we had no harvest.
Okay.
And it was coming through in hay. About $1 million a day's worth of hay was travelling through the town to local farms. And we'd set up in the mid-80s, we set up a key line irrigation system, which you'll see on the DVD, the big dam, and we were able to irrigate. We irrigated some deep-rooted crops and also pasture, and that really helped us. And also we don't have a lot of inputs. We keep our stocking rate fairly low, and we're pretty much self-sustainable. And with the water and using the water carefully and using it by the moon, we were able to make quite a good profit, when the average around here was around $70,000 deficit for the year. So, and then the following year we still made a profit when the average around the district was well into deficit as well.
How do you use the water with the moon, Ron?
How do we water by the moon? I suppose you've heard of the term of deep watering, and because we have around about 70 acres that we can irrigate, and with the key line system, I think I've explained that in the DVD, that you have contour channels running out from a big lock pipe underneath the dam wall and a gate valve, and we open the valve and let the water flood around on the contour, block the channel off, and the water floods down across the paddock. Well, if I do it, if you imagine full moon and new moon directly after, in the first 3 days, within the first 3 days of after full moon and after new moon, if I irrigate then, going over that 70 acres, it takes about 1.5 hours longer to irrigate, and I'm letting out 7,000 gallons or 30,000 litres a minute is flowing. So you could imagine 1.5 hours is 2.7 megalitres of water extra I'm using to water the same land. But the beauty of it is that instead of it lasting 1 week, it lasts me two, so I get an extra week. And at seven hours of irrigating, 7 hours to 5.5 hours, it's a lot of water, but you're actually gaining that because of the depth of the water that goes in. The other thing is that...
Ron, did I hear you correctly that you, instead of getting 7 days of benefit from the water, you're actually getting 14 days? Is that what you said?
That's right. Yes, you're getting twice the length, pretty much. And one of the reasons that I believe that's happening is because the soil life actually goes really, really gets very active around those periods, up to coming up to the full moon, and not so much, but still coming up to the new moon, and directly after it has a rest. And while it's having a rest, we actually put on all this cold water from, 6 to 10 metres down. It's cold water that floods out across the paddock. And while the soil life's having that rest, the water comes on. And when it wakes up, the moisture's there, so that it can just work with the moisture. Whereas if we put it on midstream, it's in its process of building up, and it's like you're standing in a shower that's nice and warm, and then it just someone turns the hot tap off and it just turns freezing cold. And I think that that soil life, this is only my theory, that the soil life actually goes into shock and it doesn't do the job it should do, and the country dries out a lot quicker.
Uh-huh.
That's just a theory that I have from the observation that we've been doing this now for probably nearly 20 years. We've been doing that, about 18 years, I suppose.
Well, a lot of things work for you, Ron, so I would sort of back your theory.
Yeah, well, you've heard of the deep watering, haven't you? People say, like deep watering your garden and that sort of thing.
Loosely term.
Far more efficient for the water, because you lose less water from the surface.
Yeah.
The more water you have only on the surface layers, you it's inefficient. that's a very good system.
Yeah.
Ron, you get a lot of visitors to your farm, and you get quite a few phone calls. In fact, your farm has become, it's been televised. A lot of people know of your farm. What are some of the, what's the sort of reactions? What are the sort of questions people ask you? Or, how do you sort of interact with the inquiries you get in? Well, what sort of farmers ring you up? Like, are they conventional farmers, or are they farmers who want to take a more natural approach? Can you sort of give me a bit of rundown about what happens on your farm in relation to how you relate to other farmers ringing in or making contact or visiting you?
Well, Bev cops a lot of the phone calls, so maybe I could let Bev talk a little bit about that as well, what people ring for, why they ring and that sort of thing.
That'd be lovely.
Yep. It usually is after they've had health problems. It can be with their stock, or they're not happy with their pasture, or a member of their family has got some disease that has been related to the chemicals, and then they look for alternatives. Sometimes it's even after someone has died in the family.
Mm.
They just want to come and see and compare notes, I suppose, most times.
When they do come, Bev, what do they think?
Pardon?
When they do come, when they talk to you, what's their reaction? What happens?
Most people are very happy with what they see, and they like the energy of the farm and the health of our animals.
Hmm.
And is it enough to have them change or move towards... Sorry, Bev. I said, is it enough to have them change to a more natural way of farming when they after talk to you?
I would say most people change some of their practices, and many change all of their practices to chemical-free and just living more with nature, just using natural processes.
Right. Ron, I quite often hear farmers, we might say, be very proud of the amount of kilograms of nitrogen they put out, or the amount of kilograms of grain they feed their stock, or the phosphate levels they built up in their soils, or even the injections they give their cattle to keep them healthy, and the back line of their ewes, and they're very proud of the 8,000 or 10,000 litres of milk they produce per annum. Do you think these farmers could teach you something? You sort of get a bit jealous of what of these sort of reports, or how do you relate to the farmers who report those things, or you see reports in magazines on a regular basis of people feeding their animals on a pad virtually constantly. Do you think you're missing out, Ron?
Definitely not. You see these cows that are doing the 8 and 10,000 litre averages and that, I think in America now it's 1.8 lactations, and in Australia they're talking about 2.6 lactations. Well, we're looking at cows here that are 16, 18 years old, and our animals produce around 5,000 litres per cow per year, and they'll do 10, 12, 14 lactations at that rate. So, you're looking at 60,000+ litres per animal, whereas with the others you're looking at about 25,000 litres. And over their lifetime, I could never farm with animals being sick. I just can't stand having crook animals around. So no, I'm not jealous at all. I do drive down the highway and you see these paddocks with all this grass in them, but our farm never grows that sort of quantity of grass. But what happens with the animals is that they'll go into a paddock, and the moment they walk in that paddock, they start grazing. And that's a really good indication to me, whereas I observe other farms where the animals walk in and the first thing they do is walk to the back fence. The whole herd will walk across the paddock and then they'll start grazing back. Whereas our animals, the moment they go in, they're grazing because we have a big diversity of plants. We try and have a real mixture of plants. Because those animals are in different stages of their pregnancy, they're in different stages of their cycle themselves, and at that time they need different plants. And I just watch the animals go in, and some cows will go for all the red clover flowers, other cows will go for the chicory, some will just go for the straight ordinary clover, just different things that they need. And they know animals are a browsing animal and they know what they need. But these other paddocks are monoculture. They're just a paddock of ryegrass or different crops, of single growth crops, and those animals will eat and eat and eat and never be satisfied. And I think that's one of the reasons Bev says that people ring us, because when people eat things that are not healthy for them, or they don't eat enough diversity, and when animals don't get enough diversity, then they get crook.
Yeah, Ron, that brings me to a question that someone asked me about when I talk about these examples and like on your property with cows with all those, because I have, of course, your slides in my presentation with the diverse pastures. And then one question was that, oh no, those cows just get addicted to one taste and they eat it out of addiction. It's not the need, it's addiction. What's your comment about that, Ron?
Well, do you want to mention something, Beth?
I was just thinking of the chap who came one day to have a look at our irrigator, and he was so taken with the pasture and the animals that he had to come back the second day to actually look at the irrigator.
Yes, he was very interested, just a conventional dairy farmer. But I think that what happens with these animals is that they don't know anything else, and they're craving the minerals, and what's the farmers have to do is that they have to put a mineral supplement into their grain, because they feed the cows quite heavily on grain to get these sort of production. But a cow is not a bird, and birds have crops to actually process that grain, and there's all sorts of problems come with animals eating a lot of grain. And they get diarrhea when they eat a single plant that has a lot of nitrates in it. We like to really work with the soil life, so that when you work with that soil life, you get the soil working properly, and the plants that come out of that soil are very rich and high in mineral sugars, and the insects can't attack them, and the animals really thrive on them. They only graze for maybe 2 hours of the morning, and you'll go up the paddock at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. Our animals are usually out in the paddock by 6:30, and they're all laying down with heads up, ears up, chewing their cuds, and as happy as anything. And an animal should chew her cud for about 11 hours a day.
Now, this is maybe the moment to make the quote of the VFF president, who reacted to my statement about biological farming, that cows on biological farms only graze half the time. And he then said that they needed the GM to do that quicker, because he was under the impression that you can only do that if you farm for 20 years or whatever to get the cows half-time grazing. There's all these misconceptions that people just, they don't want to know it. So have you had any interaction with that kind of powers in society, Ron, what they say and what you then can tell them out of your own experience?
Well, it doesn't worry me at all, Martin. I mean, it doesn't worry me that people, when they come here, we've had some people, farm apprentices. We had a group came from up at Maffra Way. They were third-year apprentices a few years ago. And they came for 2 hours, quite a few young farmers milking 400 or 500 cows. And I said, well, when they arrived, that you're going to see something very different here to what you've been taught, what you see, what your animals graze and that type of thing, and also your production. And by the time we'd sort of been around the farm, they'd looked at the animals, the lower stocking rate, the type of pastures we had, and they'd arrived at 10 o'clock, they were going to Fish Creek for lunch at 12, it was 1:30 and none of them were ready to leave, and the person who was taking them just could not believe that these young fellas were so interested in this type of farming that they'd even forgot to go to have lunch.
And Ron,
we've heard a couple of them did actually take on this type of farming.
And like that's the question then about, like, your experience with people that come to the farm and are completely engrossed with seeing all those good things. Do you have any feedback of people that go home to their property and start doing it, and their response, their reactions?
Yeah.
Lots.
Yes, lots, and it's really great.
Really positive.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
A couple of those apprentices now own their own farms and are farming biologically.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah, so seeing is believing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a very good comparison, Ron and Bev and Martin, in that these apprentices have come to the farm. They've been already on farms in the main. They've been on farms, as Ron says, farming 400, 500 cows, pushing like crazy, getting their 2.6 lactations out. And here they all of a sudden see the difference, and they go back and eventually own their own farms and farm biologically. I think that's saying something in itself. Martin, Ron and Bev, would you agree on that?
Yes. Yes, some of them often will say, I'd rather farm this way and enjoy life, have time to go fishing and have a few hobbies as well as work.
Mm. Yeah. Yep,
yeah,
fully agree.
That's another question, because I was, the first time I was on your property, Ron and Beth, I'm hearing the stories of Beth with the raw milk and the cures. And like in last October issue of Acres USA, there's a story about real milk cures many diseases. And like that's from a Dr. Crew from the Mayo Foundation in the 1920s. Who published an article in Certified Milk magazine, all the things that, like, curing diseases with raw milk. And he called raw milk the white blood, so powerful to cure people. And Beth,
yep.
you have done that with people in the district.
Well, one thing that people need to remember is the milk is an extension of the cow's blood. So whatever that cow eats is in the milk, and the more plants that cow can walk into a paddock and graze of high minerals and that sort of thing, the we call it a salad bar when she walks in there, and those sort of things go into the milk. And I'll let Bev explain some of the things that milk can do. Okay.
Drinking raw milk usually will get over asthma and allergies quite quickly. I've heard many cases of that. Digestive
high blood
problems.
Pressure?
I haven't actually checked anybody on that one.
Well,
but I would imagine, yes, it would.
Yeah. Lower the high blood pressure. Yeah.
Mm.
Yep.
I think
the real food is the only thing that will help health. But you have had situations, Beth, that people came to you with children or elderly people that were ill and that they cured with the raw milk.
They have been, yes. And reducing the amount of processed foods that they eat as well.
Yeah. And we call, like, the white water from the supermarkets, we call that processed food.
That is processed food, yes.
Yeah, well, Bev on our own farm here, Bev makes up quite a few things with the milk. We actually make our own butter here, we make some cheeses, Bev makes the kefir, which really enhances the bacteria in the milk, and it's very, very good for you. And yeah. It actually makes a kefir cheese by straining the kefir through a cheesecloth, and we use the whey for, we all do have organic rolled oats for breakfast, and at night in the evening Bev puts, soaks the porridge in some whey and water and leaves it soak overnight and then cooks it the next morning, and it's very, very good for you because the phytates have been actually taken out of the grain with the acid, with the whey, so There's so many things we do with it.
You can soak other grains, you can drink it, you can make sauerkraut and fermented vegetables.
Yeah.
Plenty of things to do with whey.
Hmm.
And the kefir I can use for cooking as well for a liquid yogurt.
And you make the sourdoughs and that sort of thing too, don't you?
Not all the time, but as much as I can.
Hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Good food means good health.
Ron, changing the subject a little bit, we might come back to the, what you do, Bev, but when we came on your farm and on the DVD, we saw the colour of your soil. It was pretty dark, and you'd made mention that it took you so many years to increase your soil depth. Can you sort of give us a bit of a rundown of how long it took you to increase the soil depth? And then the second part of the question, also I'd like you to answer, you might answer in the same way, answer while you're answering the first question, is if now that you know what you know now, could you fast track the how long it took you to increase your soil depth? So do you want to fire away, John, Ron, and
Yep. Okay. The soil now, the colour of the soil now is quite a rich chocolate colour, very friable. When you dig it up, it has a beautiful sweet smell to it. It's got plenty of pore space in it. Our clay in our subsoils, it used to be one inch of topsoil sitting on that clay. Now we have around about, I suppose, 12 to 18 inches over the farm, and the plants are right down into that subsoil now. I think one of the main things, I suppose, is that we've fed it with all different types of microbial enhancers, working on the minerals, remineralising, that sort of thing. You'll see that in the DVD, where we use the rock powders and the and lime, a really nice, good lime, and even used a bit of coal. But one of the things that Bev and I have found that have really broken up that subsoil is the biodynamic horn clay. It really worked on our subsoils and pushed those roots right down into that soil, so that when those roots died off, the earthworms had pushed down, and you could see, as you dig deeper, you can see the intermingled topsoil and clay mixed together. So I think, yes, we could certainly fast track it a lot quicker now. We reckon probably about an inch or a little bit more, maybe a couple of inches a year you can work on now. This new block that had the 1 inch on it has probably got about 5 inches on it now, and that's after 3 years. So, and as it gets deeper, it goes faster because of the way the soil life works.
Basalt dust also was
an
important part of increasing the worm population.
Yeah.
So, Mark, this is a question for you that I have read in official information that Australia, this is in relation to the mallee soil here in Victoria and Australia, that when farmers lose their topsoil, that it's been said, especially for the mallee area, it takes 1,000 years to produce an inch of topsoil. Well, here's Ron saying that he's produced 12 to 18 inches of soil. What's going on? What's the difference? Or, you know, what's written in how long it takes to produce an inch of topsoil? What's wrong? So, can you throw some light on that subject?
That's again, the official science in Australia still says, because we have those old soils, like our soils only make a millimeter, like subsoil, like, and it's of course the weathering process making new soil, like from the subsoil, from weathering of bedrock and things like that. That's not, of course, in the floodplains. It's a millimeter a year. And topsoil takes a lot of hard labor and inputs of organic matter. And that's the official doctrine. But like in biological farming, what we do is we don't import biological materials now. We grow the biological stuff on the land with good photosynthesis and not killing the microbes with chemicals and high amounts of fertilizers. And then that processed carbon on the spot is the carbon that Ron talks about, like an inch a year, that carbon becomes humus, the black stuff, and it goes down into the soil because the roots go deep and dense, and it's all locked up. And as soon as you use nitrogen fertilizer, that carbon burns and goes up in the sky as CO2. And to make humus, we don't have, in our current farming systems, we don't have the nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur available to make the big molecules, the humus molecules. So if then carbon becomes available in decomposition of straw and old growth in pastures, then that carbon just hangs around for a while as liquid carbon and soluble, and then it just disappears in the sky as CO2. So what Ron demonstrates is then when you have all the pieces of the puzzle together, all the spokes in the wheel, then any carbon, and the plants grow and put all the carbon in the soil, big root systems. And as soon as that root system stops being active, if roots die and new roots grow, that carbon becomes humus. And because you make humus, then the soil becomes more fertile, more water holding capacity, more available nutrients. So the roots keep proliferating, go deeper and denser.
But Martin, you, for the sake of other farmers, you related it to photosynthesis. Can you sort of explain the photosynthesis to, root depth? It's a bit of a tricky explanation.
Life on planet Earth all depends on photosynthesis. Photosynthesis, green plants, so life on Earth depends on green plants, green leaves, taking carbon dioxide from the sky and locking that up as carbon, and it's our leaf materials, the plants, the stems, the roots. So if we don't have green plants growing for us, we humans can't survive. And those green plants, of course, our forebears over the last 8,000 years, they've made crops for our food, and they've bred animals to give us the meat and the milk, etc. So it's all part of the cycle of life, and we can't break that with chemicals. Well, we do break it with chemicals. We can't replace it with chemicals because chemicals are non-living entities that disrupt that whole cycle and recycling.
Yep.
Now, Ron, you've observed quite a few things on your farm in relation to, you might say, atmospheric energy or cosmic energy, or basically energy coming from above. Let's face it, the world didn't get energy from above, we'd be freezing to death. So you have observed the influences of, I'll call it cosmic energy, on your farm. Can you sort of explain a little bit the affecting your plant growth or affecting animal behaviour? And you did mention on the DVD animals sort of birthing cycling at certain times and birthing at certain times. That's very interesting. I find it exceptionally interesting. Would you like to sort of have a bit of a chat about that, Ron?
Yeah, well, what happens is really it's back to the moon again and other things, but the plants actually put on a spurt of growth in the root system at certain times in the month, and then they will put on an above-ground growth. So we have below-ground and above-ground. And the other thing with it is that these plants are changing in their stages all the time, and that's why we have to have a big diversity of plants out there, because when they're actually the energies that are coming in and those plants are trying to change from an infant to a juvenile to an adult to a flowering stage, they are needing all different types of minerals, and they're working on pulling that out of the atmosphere, like Martin was saying, and taking it down through the actual sap, through the plant. It travels at enormous speeds and out into the roots themselves. And when you have a really good operating system like that, the plants actually have the microbes gluing themselves to the hair roots as they're working through, and taking that energy out of the sunlight, out of the air, and taking it down and putting it into those roots, and then they're trading that carbon for the minerals. Or if all that's working properly, you have a plant with a really high a high Brix reading, a high mineral sugar reading, and going from that to the insects. I'll get back to the cows in a moment, but the insects themselves have antennas. And if those minerals are not there, like Martin was talking about a chemical situation, if those minerals are not there, then that plant is trying to change stages and it can't. It can't do it properly. And it throws out a signal and those insects can hone in on that signal. Well, when the animals are grazing those types of plants as well, what farmers have to do is that they have to spray that plant because the insects are attacking it so that it's still in the paddock for the animals to eat.
What do you mean spray?
So they spray it.
Sorry?
Yep.
What do they spray with?
Well, they spray it with, they spray the, a herbicide, a pesticide of some sort to stop the insects from eating the plant.
They have
to because that plant is being attacked. That's right, yeah. And what happens then is when these animals are grazing this plant...
Well, with the poison and all?
They leave it for a certain time so that the insects are all killed and then they'll graze the plant. But what happens is that we're losing the whole balance of nature. The whole balance is being thrown out of whack. And this is what Martin was saying, that you can't put it back in with a chemical. So what happens with the animals is that when everything's working well and the cows are grazing a beautiful pasture like the first I was mentioning, then they're working with nature. And their pregnancy, all of it is the calf that's inside them. They just grow the way they should grow. And at certain times, the nature just says to those animals, it's time to calve. We've had animals here that have been busting, trying to, you know, ready to calve, but they haven't. And then, bang, you get a certain stage in the cycle, in the moon cycle, and they'll all just drop their calves. But because we carve out of season, and this is on the DVD, but I'll repeat it, that when they carve out of season, like if we carve out of season, we have a lot of other farms around us that carve beef cattle that have stillborn calves. And the phone rings and rings when our cows are not calving because of other people's cows had dead calves, and then ours will all have their calves. And it just seems to be a pattern that Bev and I have found over the years, that our cows just seem to know when to calve and when the calves are going to be strong and healthy. So everything gets out of whack. When you start putting the soil out of whack, then the energies that are coming into the plants don't work. Nature just, we're just trying to mimic nature and we can't. So what we're doing here is just working with nature, feeding those soil life the food that we believe they need, which is very similar types of foods as what we need, minerals that we need for our own bodies, and everything else falls into place.
So there is quite a correlation between cosmic energy, as Martin said, and as you just sort of described, to that of actual animal behaviour, and it's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Well, I think it's the more you study it and watch it, like Neil Kinsey, he says in his Hands-On Agronomy, and he gets around the world lecturing and that sort of thing, he says study nature, not books. And I think there's so much that we have to learn by getting out there and just watching what goes on out in the paddock itself, watching our animals and just what's happening in the soil and that type of thing. There's so much that we can learn just doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And like especially sunrise and sunset, like the first daylight and sunset, those energies are very important in the whole living organism, because then the temperatures are normal and UV, etc. is low. And then also the minerals that are floating in the sky come up with the solar energy on Earth and make connections with plants.
Mm-hmm.
So, Martin, I know it's true, but you're sort of implying that there's sort of cosmic type of particles like minerals floating in the sky or, you know, in the atmosphere.
Yeah, all the trace elements, etc. Yeah.
And Ron, would you agree with that?
Yep. There's so much. I think nature doesn't need to be bombarded with huge amounts of anything. It's like a big swing, and it just needs to be gentle. We need to be gentle with it. And I've learnt that the hard way. I was a farmer that thought, you know, so much was good, well, I'll put twice as much on and it'll be better, but that does not work at all.
Ron, well, talking about that, when it comes to solid fertilizer, what are the, some of the inputs that you're putting out and what sort of rates that you're putting out there?
Well, we do about every 5 years or so, we do what we call a roast dinner, and that's putting out coal and lime and some solid traces and different things, and reactive rock phosphate, but we actually process them before we put them out. We don't just put them out raw. But in between, we have a worm farm here, a reasonably good size worm farm, and I feed through the worms, I feed a lot of the minerals. We have a slow combustion stove. We use the ash for potash, and I use the basalt rock. I absolutely love the basalt rock powders. The cow manure, because the animals are grazing a nice mixed pasture, so the cow manure is really, it's very sweet smelling. It doesn't have a stink to it, doesn't have an ammonia smell to it. And so they get a good lot of cow manure, old hay, and we have a lot of trees here that round tree breaks, so we chip the trees that grow over the fences and leave that for a couple of years, so they get a bit of the 2-year-old wood chips in there, a bit of sawdust, and those types of things I feed into the worm farm, and then an old garden scraps and that sort of thing too, the weeds in the garden, and they run a liquid from that. I have a galvanised iron one, and I also have an old bathtub, and you have a drum underneath the bathtub and underneath the galvanised iron running down to spouting into a big drum. So in that, I'll make up a mixture of it's a 600 litre spray tank I have behind the tractor, and in that I'll put about 20 litres of worm juice, a litre of molasses, which is a sugar that feeds the microbes, and I have another drum there with about 200 litre drum with an open top, and I'll put about 20 or 30 kilos of basalt rock powder in the bottom of it. Fill it up with a pressure hose and really stir it up and leave it for about 10 or 15 minutes, even up to half an hour, and let all the rock settle to the bottom. But the dust that's off it, it's sort of the water's grey, and that's has an enormous amount of minerals and energy in that water itself. So I put in about 10 litres of that into the tank, around about 6 or 8 litres of fish fertiliser, and we make up we feed microbes with milk, molasses, and a very soft lime. So I put about 4 litres of that in, and that does about 5 hectares. I'll spread that out over about 5 hectares, so that it's a broad spectrum food for the bugs, really. And
well, those three aspects that Ron talked about, and then of course also like the biodynamic preps, the 500, 501,
yeah.
It's all these tools or the spokes, as Ron talks about, all these different parts in at the time needed in pastures, rotating those different healing mechanisms, feeding mechanisms to the system. That makes the holistic approach to farming, and the cows graze on that. Because as soon as you go to one doctrine, you are lost, because the one doctrine can't supply everything that needs to be done for plants to grow properly.
Mm. Yep, and we usually do that after a paddock has been grazed. So, you know, like the animals go in and graze that paddock off, and those plants need the soil gets a hard time with the animal's feet on it, a lot of pounding and that sort of thing. So that's what we go in with after it's been grazed, and it just it's done of an evening because it's a living product that we're putting out there. We don't put it out in the heat of the day or even in the morning when the day's ahead, because all that type of that type of food needs darkness to get into the soil before the heat of the day. So, yeah, we do that without, and I think there was a question there before about, or not on this one, but about how we put it out. I use a rooster tail or a three jetter behind the tractor, behind this tank, and I use the big jets on it, and I don't use a filter, but I strain the liquid before it goes into the tank itself.
Ron, Bev and Martin, it's a time when we should be opening the lines for anyone who's listening to ask us a question. Well, we are going to open them now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anyone there who wants to ask a question? Well, no, or we'll just keep going. Okay.
Yeah, well, maybe one question, like, because like many farmers talk about like the problems with all the stink of manures, etc. And you, with your dairy effluent treatment system, Ron, there is no smell at all. It's a living system that keeps on living. You never have to restart it or to. Well, how can you describe that dairy effluent treatment?
I feed it the same as I treat the microbes I have in a drum. We don't have any sort of dangerous products going into that. We don't have any antibiotics in our cares, any of those sort of things, and we only use biodegradable.
And you don't wash your milk with chlorine?
Chlorine?
Yeah, you don't wash your stuff with chlorine, so that the chlorine goes
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Any of those sort of products. Now, anything that will kill soil life or anything that will kill microbes, we don't like to use.
Yep.
So we just, through the animals, we hose the manure off. We use a biodegradable detergent in the dairy itself. And I use a bit of hydrogen peroxide, which is a an oxygen-charged water. And also into those ponds, I put a... I feed them with an organic molasses and a really soft lime. I feed them probably about once a fortnight, take a bucket full of each down and just put it in there. And about once a month, I'll give them a dose of those milk microbes I was talking about before.
Yeah, okay.
And also a little bit of kelp. I put a bit of kelp in there occasionally.
This goes on to the ponds.
Pardon?
This goes on to the ponds.
That goes into the ponds, yes, into the first pond. It's the what they call the anaerobic one. But when you go of an early morning and you look down on that pond, it can have up to 15 centimetres or 6 inches of foam over the pond itself. And that's where the actual bacteria during the night is working on gobbling up that food that's been going in there and produces a huge amount of oxygen. And by middle of the day, if it's a sunny day, that's all disappeared. It's just like a clear liquid. And the other funny part about it is that when the ducks come, there's a lot of ducks around here, they'll glide in and land on it, and you'll see them dipping their heads into the water and fluffing it up through their feathers. And there's no smell.
Fantastic. Ron, what's the withholding period of when you spray that out into the pasture, when you spray out from your ponds? How long before you have to keep the cows out?
Oh, you don't have to. No, you don't
Why
have to at all.
Because it's
already a processed product. It's already a living product. I don't spray it where the cows are. I usually follow, like, after the animals have finished grazing a paddock, then I'll do it. But it wouldn't matter because it's already a processed product. And that's what we do with all the solid fertilisers and those, like the worm juice and those sort of things, already processed, so that you're really just enhancing what's there. You're not actually throwing something out that the soil life has to really work hard with to break it down and then get it to work.
Sort of like a gourmet food for the...
That's right.
soil or or the water is pretty pure.
That's right. All we're actually doing is bringing more food to the table for the people. That's all we're doing, just keeping the table laden for them.
Amazing. Ron, I've been very impressed with your farm, and you are actually setting your farm up or in the future to make it into a educational centre. Would you like to sort of say a little bit about that, or is it a bit premature to be talking about that?
No, we're actually looking at taking about 4 hectares or 10 acres off a section of the triangle, and we have a lot of ideas that we'd really like to try that could be done on broadacre that we just don't get the time to do on the farm of this size. And setting it up as a teaching centre so that people can view what can be done growing these microbes and types of fertilisers, types of foods you can grow and all these types of things, so that we have, in the last 12 months or just over a year, we've had around 1,000 visitors through here, and the phone never stops ringing, and we still have a dairy farm to run as well, and it gets quite difficult at our stage of life. So we're looking at being able to get out there and get people able to see what actually happens a bit more, a bit wider, because things today are getting very difficult for farmers. Inputs are costing a fortune, whereas the inputs that we're using here cost a very, very low cost. The whole farm is the way we'd like to see farms are smaller farms with families being able to run them and being able to do a lot more things for themselves and being a lot more self-sufficient, and the community's getting stronger. And I believe that's the strength of a nation.
Okay, is there anyone there who wants to ask a question out there other than ourselves? No, it appears not. Martin, Ron, do you, is there anything else you want to say?
Well, there was a question here that I think Helen asked, and that was to me, that if I hadn't reacted to chemical fertilisers, would I have changed? This is asking me personally if I would have changed to be farming down the road that we are at the moment. I don't know, really, whether I would have changed, but I know that it was really Bev that's been the big part of being able to do this. But really, Bev and I have always asked questions. The same when I was younger. I never liked to follow the crowd, and I sort of didn't like the way, you know, animals were always getting sick and that sort of thing, and let alone myself being crook as well. But when I was a teenager, I sort of dreamt of doing something different to what was around me and actually teaching this. And I had to leave school when the credit squeeze was on in the early 60s, and because I was the eldest of 10. And it was a bit devastating for me because I wanted to go on to be a teacher. And I'm so glad that I did leave now and didn't get swayed by a lot of the a lot of what goes on through the universities and that sort of thing, and met Bev. And Bev's really been a big part of teaching me how to behave myself, not using too much of different things, and you know, being gentle with nature, and just, you know, it's just been a great way to be able to farm. Yeah. It's been a terrific time. So yeah. I'm really glad that we did change.
And that brings the end to our latest Talk the Walk. Unfortunately, our recording cut out, so I'm saying goodbye. Martin, Bev, Ron and Hugo all say goodbye to you too, and thank you for listening. Bye-bye for now.